Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to Lecture 16, Maps and Spatial Reasoning. Okay, we're going to finish off the material on the third dimension, on heights on maps. And we're going to do it by looking at some of the more recent technologies that have come about that allow us to do detailed mapping now at extraordinary levels of accuracy. Then on Friday, we'll move ahead and start looking at geographic data and information. We'll start by looking at Stephen's levels of data. Okay, so let's, without delay, we'll get launched right on in. So how do we initially calculate heights of places around the landscape? Well, we used a tried and trusted method called leveling. And this country was leveled, as much of the world was, mostly during the 19th century. And leveling is the principle by which we lay out a baseline, which can then be used for triangulation. Triangulation I'll also discuss in just a minute. Basically, we're going to measure, we're going to go to prominent locations, set up an instrument that looks somewhat like that, although that's a level, not a theodolite. On a tripod, we're going to measure the distance between the ground and the instrument, and then we're going to look at things through here, targets, that are prominent features on the landscape or places where we can set up other stations. And we can use the horizontal angle on here to measure the distances and form triangles for these objects. We link those triangles together in three dimensions, so we've got both the vertical angle and the horizontal angles. And we solve all the triangles, then we solve all the positions, and then the rest of mapping is filling in all the detail that goes in between the points. So we call this control, or control surveying. And control, as we saw earlier when we were talking about geodesy, initially needs some kind of length to be laid out that's going to be a standard length that's going to continue through the series of triangles. That's called a baseline. And in a baseline, the two ends of the baseline have to be part of the triangulation. And those are the lengths that give you the solutions to all of the triangles. These lines have to be, in the process of leveling, have to be absolutely horizontal. And then we can measure displacements from them up and down using instruments like this, like a survey rod. So these are all different technologies for producing baselines. In the earliest days, back in the sort of 18th century, they were often done using wooden poles of a given length, and you'd simply you'd use the fact that there's three of them, or at least three, to line up the two ends so that you lay them out in a perfect straight line. So you look along the length of the line to lay out the next one, you pick up the last one and take it and put it at the front, and just simply measure the length going from one place to another. That's a little bit tedious if you're laying out a lot of country all at the same time. So most baselines in the United States were done in this way, having a metric wheel that was pushed along. It was a known distance, a diameter around the wheel. So you push it along, you count how many times the wheel turns around, and this gives you a measured length to form a baseline on the ground. When we get into more accuracy and precision, we begin to worry about these rods and just how reliable they are and how sturdy they are. For one thing, most materials, including metal, expand or change their length when they're warm or wet. It depends on the circumstances. So eventually they standardized in the 19th century on using glass rods, which would not expand or contract, but were, of course, a little hard to carry around in detail. So this is a leveling effort where each part of the glass rod is being laid out on its own tripod and making sure that the thing is absolutely level. And you have to make sure that your ends line up perfectly so that you don't leave a gap between them, which would incorporate more length. And, of course, here we can measure distances using stadia. It's the simplest distance. Way to measure distance, we've already covered this in the class. So baselines are important. They allow us to set up the geodetic control. Here's the geodetic control, often inscribed on benchmarks, which are permanent features left on the landscape. Those are also going to appear on the map. So they're a very important tie between the three-dimensional form of the landscape and the way it's represented on the map. You can imagine that surveying the entire country, filling all the so-called detail, as mappers call it, that's everything that fits between the benchmarks on the maps, in other words, everything, This took a good, well, for most of the country, it took about 100 years to go from one end to the other to survey all the different positions. And that includes every little island in the coastline. Here we are, plane table surveying. I have one of these in my office. A tripod with a flat surface on the top, which can be moved around and made precisely level, has a series of screw holes in it, so you can actually screw a piece of paper down to it so it doesn't move. And then you can mark off indicators using this instrument. It's called a plane table alidade. It allows you to simply look through an angle and then draw the line to that point, literally draw it on the paper on top of this board. And you can take plane tables pretty much anywhere. I'm glad I wasn't that guy surveying that canyon. So by this case, in 1937, what we had was a network of triangulations running across the entire country. And you can see that parts of the country extremely well covered with triangulations. There are so many individual triangles that they all sort of fuse into one black blob here. And you can see that there were systematic attempts to run triangulation lines from coast to coast along parallels and then south to north along meridians, and that various survey systems for different states had to align. And obviously, the surveying the Mexican border and the Canadian border become a priority, so getting those surveys linked in with Mexico's surveys and Canada's surveys were important as well. So the agency with the responsibility for doing this is called the Coast and Geodetic Survey. It's probably the oldest mapping organization in the country. It's now part of NOAA, the National Ocean Service, but it's still there and it still deals with the geodesy and the control data supporting the United States. So these are the most accurately known locations, and it explains why we have so many benchmarks and so on for each of the individual maps. Then, as we've seen over the course of the class, things changed quite radically in 1970. And this was the era in which the space race was taking off and the first satellites were being launched, and we were detecting the subtle differences in gravity between the Earth-based ellipsoids, which were pretty much configured for the mapping of each individual country, and global ellipsoids, those models that fit best the gravity field of the entire planet. So there was a need felt that we should go over to a single ellipsoid for the entire world and that it should be standardized. The very first one that was Earth-centric, as far as the ellipsoid was concerned, was the World Geodetic System, or WGS-70, and it's been systematically improved since then. Obviously, WGS-84 was pretty much a landmark, a value that has become a standard, but even that continues to be refined as we move towards the International Terrestrial Reference Frame and the values that lead to the geoid as a fit. Why was this series of points chosen for the first global triangulation? Because we can't see, there's no line of sight like in regular triangulation between these locations. So what we were dealing here was radio signals or signals that could be received from satellites. So you might say this is the beginning of the satellite mapping era. That location right there in red is Vandenberg Air Force Base, and that is where the lift pads had to be first put into place and measured very accurately to make sure that you got the trajectories and so on correct. So you see, it is rocket science. About before this era, we were seeing a major transition within cartography from the old methods that I showed you on the first slide, the filling in of detail by plane table and the filling in of survey markers by triangulation, was being replaced by a new set of methods. They started during World War I, were used on the first sort of mass scale during World War I for trench mapping in France and Belgium. Techniques came back and sort of sat on the back burner until World War II, and then in World War II, the use of aerial photography just simply took off because so much of the world needed to be mapped very quickly, because new methods were becoming available. This was one of the first army mapping cameras that was able to capture enormous amounts of the world's area on film. The methods, of course, at first were rather primitive. I'm not sure it's a good idea to get out of the plane to take a photograph, but that's what you had to do. Later on, they realized you could cut a hole in the bottom of the plane, stick the camera through the hole, and it was just as good. So that's pretty much the same way we do it today. So this, I would argue, is every bit a part of the nuts and bolts of cartography, as is plane tables and theodolites. This is your standard 9-inch black and white aerial photograph that comes out of the latest generation of mapping cameras, although I should say that analog film is now almost completely replaced by digital cameras, so even this is ready for a museum. A few things to point out. This is the metadata associated with the image, so this image indexing and how it fits in with other images is obviously extremely important. We have to get the sequences right if we're going to turn them into a map, so we need a decent numbering code. This is at the scale of 1/24,000, so we need to standardize this. And we would like that picture to have all of the characteristics of a map. In other words, we would like the photograph to have none of the characteristics of perspective view, as we would get with our eyes, and the property of a map where everywhere is overhead at the same time. So we have no perspective, the so-called orthographic view. A couple other things to note. These are very important markers here. There's one at the top, one at the bottom. And trust me, there's one on either side. They got cut off on this slide. Those are very important because they're actual marks on the camera, and those marks on the camera allow us to make calculations from the photograph to do what's called photogrammetry, or measurement, just as we've done cartometry, measuring from maps. We can now measure from the photos. In fact, we can measure many of the things that we need to make maps directly from photographs as well. So you should all take one glimpse at this and say, Township and Range survey system, right? But something else is going on here. As you can see, we've got a little diagonal stretch going on within the system. The geometry of an aerial photograph is relatively straightforward until you really start to think about it. If we assume the terrain is flat, more about that in just a minute, we can talk about an axis that goes from the center of the lens right here to the center of the image, what's called the principal point. That's where those tick marks here and here, if we drew a line between those, and here we drew a line between those, we would have a place in the center of the image that's pretty much directly beneath where the plane was at the particular time when the shutter was opened. We know the focal length of the camera. Cameras have focal lengths. You can decrease that length by putting in a series of mirrors and prisms to fold it backwards and forwards, but basically the longer the focal length of the camera, the better the resolution of the image that you're going to get. And then we have the height of the aircraft, and we know some relationships between the size of the image and the lengths on the image, the lengths, equivalent lengths on the photo, the focal length of the camera, and the height at which the plane was flying. So we can use those to figure out distances, lengths, the scale of the image, and so on, important things that we're going to need to know if we're going to do mapping. Now, one of the biggest problems with taking aerial photographs is that they're not orthographic. If you think about it, the ideal aerial camera would be an array of cameras over an area that was as large as the ground that it was photographing. So like a 1,000 balloons floating in a grid or something like that in a network would take an overhead view of every point at the same time. But when you take a single shot from a plane, you're getting a perspective view of everything that's not directly beneath you, let's call it the nadir point of the image. And basically, the further away you are from the center of the image, as this is the image center here, imagine these four poles and different parts of the image, we're going to see those as occluded, so we're not going to see a dot, which would be perfectly over top the pole. We're going to see them as a line, and the length of the line is going to depend upon how far away we are from the principal point of the image. So they're going to displace radially away from the center of the image. So they're all pointing, the lines that they make are all going to point towards the center of the image. And the length of each one, even though they're the same on the ground, is going to be longer as we get towards the edge of the image. So we actually have quite a bit of distortion present within a regular image. We're used to seeing and accounting for it in our own views, but in fact our own, even our day-to-day vision, suffers from this parallax effect. And includes radial displacement. Okay, then we'll complicate things a little bit further because Of course, the ground is not level. We're probably able to fly reasonably well. You can imagine that if we've got a film plane, we've got the equivalent geometry on the photograph as we have on the film plane here. But we might have points A and B on the image which are at different heights. So we, in other words, our terrain is going to suffer from radial displacement as well as we go away from the center of the image. And what's more, even if we assume there's a datum plane that runs through the image, then we're going to have to map the elevations on the image up or down onto that plane when we do our mapping. This is how we're going to generate contour lines and so on. Okay, so we might have a nadir point, we might have a displaced point that's actually on the plane that's going to be offset from the nadir point. So, in other words, the geometry of the image is going to be quite complicated because it's going to be determined not just by radial displacement, the height of the camera, the focal length of the camera, but also by the topography, the lay of the land. Okay, one thing we can do if we do have control information about the photograph, let's say we have our corner points, so we can find the principal points, just draw a line between those and we get our principal point. We can measure the distance of a point here. You can see that this, let's say this is a building, this point here is exactly the same as that point there. It's the two edges of the building, or you better hope that it's the same point, because in other words, the building's vertical. So we can tell the height of the building by the amount of difference in the radial displacement between the base and the top of the building. So if we know a little bit about three-dimensional form, we can use the radial displacement to actually calculate heights. Notice here that we've got a PP, or a principal point, and a CPP. That stands for the conjugate principal point. That's the principal point on the next image in the sequence. So we should have multiple views of this same building with a different amount of displacement on them, differential displacement. So this is present in all sorts of images. Here's one that I popped up. I believe this is the 2006 one-foot aerial photographic coverage of the campus. Just let me point out a few things on this. It's changed quite a bit. Those huts have disappeared, for example, just very recently. This is Ellison Hall here. And you can see that for Ellison Hall, we're pretty close to the nadir for the photograph because we can't see the sides. We can just see a little bit of the side here of this part. This part, we're pretty much directly overhead. So the nadir point for the image has got to be somewhere around here. You see, as we move away from that point, let's come over here, for example, to this corner of the chemistry building. Now we can see this face and this face of the chemistry building. It appears to be sort of leaning over. In other words, this point here is the same as that point there. So we can see the angle. If we followed that line, we would eventually reach the principal point, which is somewhere down here. We can also figure out how tall this is if we know how far that is from the principal point. As you can see, as we get over even further away from the principal point, over here, like in the physics building, you can see that there's quite a lot of displacement now. We can see these two sides, but not the other ones. And now we've got considerably more displacement because we're further away from the center of the image. Let me see. The other thing I was going to point out with this is that, well, here's one of the controls on the image. I was going to point out this. See that mark on the lawn? Any idea what's just happened?
Lawnmower
could be. No, it looks like pretty dry. It was beginning to be pretty dry. We couldn't guess the time of the year very well. I'd have to look at specific trees. But they've just laid out the career fair here. And everywhere where people have been walking between the stands has been squashed down, so it looks a different color. So this is an idea of photo interpretation. You can often read enormous amounts of information from a photograph if you know what to look and where to look for it. Okay. Just in case you thought it was simple to map from aerial photographs, you also have to deal with the fact that the plane is not going in a perfectly dead straight line. It just wouldn't be possible to do that because it's flying through the air. And the three important angles, as far as mapping are concerned, are the roll, the pitch, and the yaw of the aircraft. So the roll is fairly easy to understand. It's just simply As the plane turns from side to side, it loops this way and that. And what's that going to do with the camera? Well, imagine that this is the light from my camera. I'm shining down the surface. As I roll, my nadir point's going to drift from side to side. So that's going to offset the entire image and certainly deal, sort of wreak havoc with the displacement pattern on the image. Pitch is the angle of attack of the aircraft. So when it's climbing, initially the pitch is very high. That's why when a plane first takes off, you have to put your seatbelts on because it's going to tilt up, tilt backwards as we're climbing. It's going to tilt down as we're coming in for a landing. And so any time we climb, we pitch forward. And what's that going to do? Well, if we're climbing, my nadir, instead of being directly underneath, is now going to track in front of the plane or behind the plane. And I may have to have an angle of attack because I've got heavy headwinds or light headwinds or whatever. And then the last aspect here is that usually the plane wants to head into the wind, just like a ship wants to head go with the current. And anytime we want to fly against the wind direction to come up with a travel vector, we have to tilt the direction in which the plane's actually going. So this means that the track of the plane on the ground is it sort of has the plane going sideways like this. We come up with a result vector of all the winds and forces acting on the plane, the thrust of the plane, and the result is this yawed vector on the ground. So the effect of each one of these motions is going to move the principal point away from the center of the image. It's going to move the coverage of the image. We can have motion in X, we can have motion in Y, we can have tilt in X, we can have tilt in Y, we can have movement in Z, that is that the equivalent height of the plane is going to be different from what we measure, perhaps different even within the frame of a single scene. And then we have rotation or swing. So the axis of the map or the image that's taken and then rectified to the map is going to need to be turned back into sort of north rather than direction of movement of the plane. And this doesn't happen uniformly, of course. So when we add together the roll, pitch, and yaw of the plane, all the differences associated with the geometry of the photograph, and the fact that we have radial displacement due to the topography of the surface. The surface isn't flat. When you put all these together, you get quite an uneven view of the landscape. So if we start with an image, it might look something like this. We can go to the known points that we can calculate, or we can put we can measure places that we know the location of on the ground. Let's say highway intersections or bridge points or something like that. We can then calculate the amount of distortion present at every point and apply what's called a rubber sheeting transformation. You imagine the maps, well, the image has been printed on a rubber sheet, and we can pull it along, put a pin through it, pull it a little bit more, put another pin through it, and keep doing that until we force the image to be in the same geometry of the ground. Now, today this isn't done mechanically, this is done digitally, but the principles are pretty much the same. So we take the imperfect geometry of the photograph as it comes directly from the aircraft or spacecraft, and we warp it, we distort it so that it matches the ortho view as if we were overhead at every point on the ground at the same time, the way a map is. Okay, we have, how are we going to do that? Well, it would be ideal if we had something marked on the ground that we could also see in the image. If we then take, here's one that's from the neighborhood near where I live, that was painted out for one of the recent aerial photo surveys. You occasionally see these on campus. There's one on the roadway just as you drive in the East Gate. You find them all over the place as you walk around different towns or anywhere where there's mapping taking place. So this is an airphoto target. This one has been painted on the sidewalk, and a surveyor has come out and probably used GPS to very precisely locate that dot. Okay. Now when I see that same thing on the image, when I can pick out the dot because I know where it is and find it, now I can assign the coordinates that I measured at that actual location with that location on the photograph. And if I have a large number of these control points, then I can apply that transformation that brings the image into its correct map geometry, rather than being distorted by all the forces that have come into play when the photograph was taken. Ortho rectification can make an enormous difference. So here's a downtown Gee, I have no idea where that is. I think it might be Denver. Not sure. You can see enormous amount of radial displacement on these buildings and on this tower. When we pull them back into their orthorectified view, now that tower is vertical. This tower has become here, and we can actually see the top of it. The footprint's pretty small for that. And we can see the layout of the roads, and we're not seeing a distorted view of the landscape. So orthorectification is the first thing we need to do with an image before we can begin using it for mapping purposes. And increasingly, images like this have sort of become maps. You know, we can choose what we use in, say, Google Earth or Google Maps, and often people prefer to look at the satellite image or the aerial photograph rather than looking at the street maps, or they prefer some kind of hybrid, like with the streets and the street names, but with the image beneath it. So you might say the images have become the map. Okay, so anybody that's ever been to visit the Washington Monument in D.C. Knows that the geometry of this is fairly straightforward and simple. There are lots of hints that tell us about this geometry. We can look at the height, we can look at radial displacement. We know the height, so we can use that for calibration. Here we also know the shadow, so if we know the time and the season in which the photograph was taken, we can simply look up what the sun angle should have been and use that to calculate the height or to even calculate distances. So shadows can also be quite effective as a means of photogrammetry. But if you've ever been to this location, you'll know that this tower sits on a little hill. The hill's pretty much this entire park that surrounds it, and it's got quite a bit of elevation. We can see the building elevation quite clearly, but we can't tell much about what's going on as far as the topography of the landscape's concerned. And that's pretty much going to be the way as long as we stay with a single image view of the landscape. But there is a solution. You know, we have two eyes. We are beings that have one eye on each side with separations, about 2 degrees of separation between the two eyes. So we're getting slightly different views all the time. And our brain is assembling those slightly different views into a 3D to make it appear as if we see the world in 3D. So if we take two photographs, and there are special cameras that allow you to do this, you can buy the cameras that take stereo photographs in a sort of specialist camera store. So when you take two photographs and look at them through a device that puts one image to one eye and the other image to the other eye, then our brain, once again, rebuilds the image and we see it as if it were in three dimensions. Stereoscopes, the devices for looking at these images, have sort of gone in and out of fashion over the years. They were enormously popular in sort of Victorian, Elizabethan times, or not Elizabethan, Victorian era. It became sort of everybody had one in their living room, and you could buy postcards that you can mail to each other that showed three-dimensional views of pretty much everything. Then it kind of disappeared completely, but now we've rediscovered it, and now we see movies in 3D, and you can even buy 3D televisions. All they're doing is just rediscovering this standard principle of stereo vision. So the subtle differences between these two views, you don't necessarily notice it, unless you say consider the angle of this sidewalk here, which is clearly different in the two images. And our brain does an excellent job of reassembling the image back and making it look as if it's in 3D. We can simulate the same effect from an aircraft just with a regular camera run. So if we, here's the aircraft at one time period and here it is slightly later. If this is the image space underneath, for the first point, and we take that image, then there's our nadir point for it. If we then take another picture a little time later, we've got a second view. Here's the second one. Here's its nadir point. And notice that the two nadir points are both included in both images. So now we can use the fact that we've got two principal points within the image to begin to reconstruct the image in stereo. For one thing, we can put the two images under something called a mirror stereoscope, so that when we look through a binocular view, one eye sees one of the two images and the other eye sees the other one, and now we can see this in stereo. Okay, we can do a lot with the image geometry when we're working in stereo. Generally speaking, we get double overlap when we do air photo runs. So anybody that's ever been out there on a nice clear summer, usually on a sunny summer's day, because they want no clouds, when you see a plane, it just sort of flies by. And you see it approaching, appears to be flying in a dead straight line, and then a few minutes later it flies back in the opposite direction, going what looks like on pretty much exactly the same track. Well, that plane's taking aerial photographs of the campus or wherever it might happen to be, and it usually does it in the same sequence. So you do these overlapping views with about 60% overlap between the two frames, and then when we reach the end of our run, we simply turn around and we go this way, so we get a side lap or a side overlap between the photographs of about 30%. So now there are parts of the image, parts of the landscape are going to be imaged four times on adjacent overlapping photographs. So now we're going to be able to see any part of the photograph in stereo if we need to. Now we've got quite a bit more information about height. We can use what's called differential parallax. So now we've got the principal point of this image, which is the center. We just connect the four corners. Here's the principal point in this image, but this principal point is that principal point from the next image. So it's called a conjugate principal point. And we can measure this distance and this distance and use those to calculate distances and heights of almost anything else on the image. So now we've got the ability to use the stereo principle to calculate heights as well, because we've got slightly different views of the same object from different views. There are a few cases where it doesn't work, like we're never going to be able to see the back side of a building until we come around on the next overlap frame, but that's okay. So to plan how we're going to take photographs is a very important process. So this involves, if you study aerial photography, you spend a lot of time trying to figure out exactly the geometry of how you're going to cover the area that you're interested in. Let's say it's a county that you've contracted with the county to take photographs. You want to take as few photographs as possible, and you want to be in the air as little as possible, because any time a plane's in the air, it's like throwing money away. So the idea is you try and figure out exactly how to do the most mapping with the right stereo overlap coverage in the least amount of effort. This is actually a flight map from the flight of the ER-2, the high-altitude plane that used to be the U-2 spy plane. It still gets used occasionally. Here it is taking off from NASA Ames in the South Bay and flying out over the Central Valley and then doing a series of long loops and then closer loops. So obviously, this is with two different cameras, so we can get different types of mapping taking place with two different cameras. And the images that come back look pretty much like this. We've got overlap between the strips and the side lap between them here. I was at a conference last year and looking at how this used to be done, which is pretty much like this, almost mechanically, by hand, and how it's done now. You just simply say where you want the coverage to be, and the computer calculates where the plane's going to fly. In fact, the computer then uploads the navigation information directly into the GPS on the plane, so the pilot doesn't have to even touch the controls. The plane's going to fly itself to get the best possible view of the ground. But for years and years, we processed photography in the analog, and that meant usually getting something that was very stationary, because you didn't want the images to move around as you were taking measurements from them. So that meant getting something really heavy. And here's some examples of enormously heavy tables in this case, and in this case a stereoscope, that were deliberately sort of built out of heavy steel and concrete, made them impossible to install or get rid of later. But the idea was to have something immensely stable that could then be used as a platform off which to map. So here we've got, this is in fact a pantograph. We've got this computer, as she was called. This was before digital computers. Computers used to be a job description. She is tracing off, let's say, a coastline off of this aerial photograph down here, and that's being enlarged to the right scale, which is set by changing the lengths of these arcs, and then traced off here on the final product map. It's on this side. literally traced off by hand. That's how they were made. They even had these long, for drawing graticules, they had long pieces of metal that could be bent slightly, so you got the right curvature on the graticule, and then you draw the line along them. As you can imagine, doing this on board a ship or something was quite tedious. Here's that same instrument over here, or very similar to it. It's a plotting device. This is a stereoscope. Before the photographs could be processed on paper, analytically, they used to shoot them directly onto glass plates. The glass plates would then go into illuminated enclosures with these are lights above them to shine the light through, and the light could then be projected and placed in stereo up through this viewing device. And what this guy has, two wheels you can control that move the image around, and usually you have a foot pedal that controls the focus. So you're moving in and out of focus and then moving the image around with your two hands like this. It's a really weird thing to see. What is it doing? Well, what he's doing is trying to move the images around without changing the elevation of the dot that he's seeing on the surface. So if I put the dot down onto the surface, manipulate the height so that it's touching the surface, and now I move the images around so that I can follow the same height, what am I doing? I'm tracing a contour. Okay, so this is how all those contour lines on the maps were actually produced, using some god-awful looking piece of equipment like this. I once had, when I had a department once that actually owned one of these things, big Kelch plotter, and we couldn't get rid of it. I mean, it was like a permanent entity. It was too big and too cumbersome to deinstall. It just had to sit there forever. Today, when we do the equivalent, we do in software and use so-called soft copy photogrammetry. So the image never exists as anything other than a set of digits. This is the typical workstation. This is actually in a mapping office here where the stations are being used. This is a typical configuration. This is a more precise one that allows more metrics. So this is the digital equivalent of the huge plotter I showed you on the last frame. This is a more common one. Now we have a trackball rather than those wheels to move around, but the principle is pretty much the same. Usually now the screen is going to show the image in stereo, either anaglyphic or shuttered stereo. We've looked at some of that a little bit before. So these are shuttered stereo glasses. We're looking at two images simultaneously, but the principle is exactly the same. We're looking at objects in three dimensions, and we're tracing where they are off of the image so that we can place them on the map. So this is how the maps are actually being produced. Same thing works for contours, although often contours are done automatically now. You don't need to trace them off by hand, because the computer can simply solve the parallax equation for every point on the image simultaneously. Then we come into some of the new technologies. I said I was going to talk about new technologies. And the first one that came around, dating from about the 70s, was synthetic aperture radar. We all know what radar is. It's kind of what we look at to land aircraft and so on. We've even seen it in the class. But generally speaking, a radar sits at a point where it broadcasts. It sweeps a band around itself continuously, so it has to refresh the beam, and it measures the distance responses out to where something or part of that signal came back again. Well, if you can simulate the way that a radar pulse happens, you can narrow it so it comes out of a narrow aperture, like a slit. So it's like being able to shine light through a little tiny slit. You can control now exactly where that's going to go. So SAR, or synthetic aperture radar, is an instrument that can sit on almost any kind of an aircraft. It has a side-scanning device that allows it to sweep across the landscape, mapping one little tiny swath of the landscape at a time. But it's doing exactly what a regular radar does. In other words, it sends out a pulse, that interacts with the land surface and bounces back to the aircraft. And if we measure the amount of bounce back continuously, we can get good information about the topography, about what's happening on the length of that sweep. Then as the plane moves forward a little bit further, we can sweep the next one, and so on. When we piece them all together, we can begin to build a three-dimensional map of the landscape. Same thing works for Same thing works for stereo with radar as it does for visible light. So we can then do what's called interferometric synthetic aperture radar, or IFSAR, in which we image the whole area twice and look at the displacements that took place between the two images because of the different viewpoint. And from that, we can calculate the heights of the object with a good degree of accuracy. So really quite good accuracy. So this is a terrain model that's being of Haley, Idaho, that's been built from synthetic aperture radar. You can see some of the problems that are inherent in radar. So this surface of the mountain, for example, was reflected directly back to the signal. So it comes out with a lot of resolution on it. We can see a lot of detail. This one is facing pretty much away from the radar, so it's mapped with less detail. So we've got differential levels of detail within a single image. That's not ideal, but, you know, been there before with photography. But you'll see that the radar itself has quite a complex interaction with the ground. So it sees all sorts of features. It doesn't see clouds or mist or haze or anything like that. It does interact with the landscape of the ground. So what we're getting here is responses from trees and field boundaries and roads and all sorts of things. They're being imaged differentially. One of the problems with radar is that it often gets scattered, that the radar, instead of reflecting back neatly, gets bounced off in all directions. So the problem in the image, we call this speckle. So we get speckle within the image, and there's sort of like random errors within the image. But generally speaking, what we can back out is much more important, much more significant. So here's a digital elevation model created from synthetic aperture radar that's been processed interferometrically. In other words, there are two sweeps. And you can see that things like individual buildings and here's looks like a little burrow pit or a pond, individual highways, this is part of a mine area here. You can begin to get immense amounts of detail from the topography. And the latest generation IFSAR, called GeoSAR, that's being flown all over the place right now, mostly still in the military realm, can image in extraordinary detail, even under a dense canopy. And we can put synthetic aperture radar on spacecraft. And in fact, there are systematic satellites that just do radar mapping from space. The Chinese operate one, the Canadians operate one called RadarSat. The late 90s and early 2000s, there was an international expedition that put the synthetic aperture radar on the space shuttle. They built an enormous telescoping radar that could have two transmitters and receivers at the either end of a huge long beam. And I went down to JPL in Pasadena to see it when they were building it. It was enormous, like this whole length of a football field long. And this whole thing concertinaed up, could go inside the shuttle bay, and then it opened in orbit. And in the space of the orbit, we're able to map the entire Earth, well, between about 56, 57 north and 57 south, the part of the Earth that the shuttle was able to orbit from. Since we could do multipass, so the nice thing about orbiting is that the Earth's rotating beneath you, so you image the same area over and over again, but actually you're imaging one part during the day and another part during the night from two different directions. So you get the advantage of having stereo in there, so you can process it interferometrically. So what was done with this information is the device deployed. That's what it looked like. Here's the huge SAR here, and the other one inside the shuttle here. Here's the area that was mapped over the entire Earth. You notice it didn't include much of the Arctic regions, unfortunately. But when the data were finally processed and put together, they released this map at a resolution of 90 meters for the entire Earth. And in many places, this is still the best topography that you can get. Here's North America pulled out of it and then mapped. There were some known problems with this. It wasn't particularly good at water bodies, lakes and the ocean, especially when there were large waves, were not imaged very well. But most of those were corrected for, and the data is still sort of in doing its service right now. This was called the Shuttle Radar Topographic Mapping Mission, SRTM, and you can go on the internet and download all this information if you want. If SAR is so useful that it's being used systematically by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to map the coastlines of the country, and they have this thing called the IFSAR viewer that you can go into and pull out any piece of the coastline and then look at the topography as they've constructed and measured it from the IFSAR flights. Now, this is about to be repeated quite likely with LIDAR. But this does allow you to get some very detailed three-dimensional information. You can see it, the 3D of the campus stands out pretty clearly. You can see the cliffs along the east side of the campus and see the bluffs there inside the lagoon quite clearly. Here's just to show you that it works. Here's two different representations of IFSAR coverage for Thousand Oaks, not too far away. And as you can see, the effect of humans when they build on the landscape is to level each individual land parcel that's going to be built upon. So we've got dozens of cases here where individual streets have been leveled and then almost like little platforms have been made for the houses to sit on because everybody wants a flat yard. You can see the effect of that on the landscape. This is a flat area because it's a lake or a reservoir. It must be a reservoir. And you can see that it comes out as flat on here, which is as it should. Okay, the instrument that everybody's excited about right now for mapping topography is LIDAR. LIDAR works a little bit differently. It involves what's called pulse laser. So, similar technology to what I've got here. Imagine that I'm able to know the precise position of my aircraft, and that's done using kinematic GPS techniques. And then I can just move the scan dot backwards and forwards across the landscape very quickly and measure the return that I get from each individual dot in the landscape. So here's the aircraft. We've got all the normal things that we need to measure, like the roll, pitch, and yaw. But we have GPS that allows us to get the precise geometry. We can control for it by having a station on the ground as well. In fact, we use the CORS network data for processing LIDAR information. Here are all the points interacting with the ground surface. And we can set the even from an aircraft at a fairly high elevation, we can capture easily one point for every square meter on the ground, and sometimes a good deal better than that, very much better than that in a lot of cases. Now, the nice thing about light is that some of it bounces off the first thing it sees, some of it penetrates a little further and bounces off, and then some of it goes all the way through the tree canopy, say, and comes up from the surface. So we may not be seeing it with our eyes because it's fairly dark underneath the tree canopy, but LIDAR is possible of imaging what's on the surface. So in this case, we've got exactly the same image, but on the left, we've got the returns from the LIDAR, obviously corrected for their position. The first response, so this is the first thing that photons hit as they were approaching the landscape. So this is giving us the top of the tree canopy. And this is the last thing that they hit, which is the bare surface of the ground. And I can simply subtract that from this, and now I've got the volume of all the vegetation and buildings on my landscape. I can process those to see where the buildings are and the roads and so on with a good deal of accuracy. So many people argue that you can use LIDAR as the only source of information for making maps, and it is quite convincingly so. Here's the regular digital elevation model. It might be smooth from the contours that we might get. This is a LIDAR response. This is from San Francisco. Not only can we see buildings with LIDAR, we can see different parts of the roof and the direction in which they're facing, things like chimneys on the top of buildings, where every single tree and shrub is located, and we can even make out things like roads and driveways pretty easily from LIDAR data as it gets to higher and higher resolutions. Now, a few years ago, we did some LIDAR mapping of the campus for a project I was working on. So here's all the point returns from the satellite colored by their height. So you can see that this is the tallest part of the library, which gets brown, and this is not so tall. Here's Ellison Hall over here. The highest part is just that over the elevator shafts in the front of the building, which is why the antenna dish is right next to it, and so on. Here's the complete coverage of the swath that we got. As you see, it covers most of the campus. You can see the taller buildings over here showing up in red, and then the less tall buildings in IV, and then this is Devereux Slough over here. When you look it up and view it in perspective, here's the view of the buildings and the way they appear. This is Isla Vista. Here's the campus on this side. There's a lagoon over here. And you can see things like Stork Tower, which show up very clearly in this information. You can also collect terrestrial LIDAR. So you don't need an aircraft to collect LIDAR. You can do it from the ground. This is the instrument the department owns. It's run by Bodo Buchhagen. It's on the faculty in geography. And here we took it over to the engineering science building and just stuck it down on the landscape. Actually, we put it there. You can see it doesn't collect data super nearby. There's sort of a hole where it doesn't collect data, but it does collect pretty much everything, including the trees, and this blue blur is somebody who walked past as the scan was going across. And we actually caught the person moving there. So that we can make depth fields, we can make three-dimensional fields, and do very, very detailed three-dimensional mapping with this instrument. We can also do things like this. I think I've already shown you this image. See exactly where a particular contour traces out in the landscape, and therefore where flooding may occur. I've already mentioned the DFIRMS, the Digital Flood Flood Insurance Risk Maps. These are all being redone using LIDAR now where it's available, so there's an enormous effort underway to remap the country, pretty much part of every state using LIDAR. Okay, so here's my wrap-up, right on time. First generation topographic mapping, it was based on triangulation, plane table, baselines, and simple surveying instruments that have changed very little over hundreds of years. Second generation was based on analog photography. So we saw the whole country remapped using aerial photographs. And those were basically treated mechanically and used for making direct measurements. The current generation is using IFSAR and LIDAR and mapping sufficiently that we can go straight to digits. We don't need photographs or even paper maps in between. The accuracy is simply unprecedented. I mean, the mapping we're doing with the LIDAR on campus, we're getting a point about every 2 centimeters, and it's the drift on it within a whole frame is less than a couple of centimeters. So it's really more accurate than the most extreme accuracy of the previous generation of accuracy. And then, of course, once you can do this, you have to worry about what you map. So LIDAR can see the top of vegetation, the top of buildings, and then also the bottom of the landscape. Traditionally on maps, we only put the bottom of the landscape on the image. We ignore vegetation. But increasingly, we can put those objects on the map too. Okay, see you all on Friday.